When you did hear about the state or local level, it was usually in a program or study group that fused the two together in the compound phrase state and local, pronounced almost as if it were one word, state and local. These dynamics were set in opposition to national politics, and states usually got attention for the tension between them and the federal government, as if state-federal power struggles were all that mattered in federalism. Yet some of the most important policy dynamics of our time have to do with the relationships and the tension between state and local government. I knew as soon as I took office that it would be important to form a positive relationship with our Republican governor, Mitch Daniels. Daniels was first elected in 2004 when he defeated South Bend's own Joe Kernan, making him a villain to Democratic partisans around here. A compact man, known for a powerful intellect and a temper that could flare up on occasion, he had been a protege of Senator Dick Lugar and served alternately as a top pharmaceutical executive in Indiana and a Republican White House official. By the end of his tenure, Daniels was popular across the state and often mentioned as a presidential prospect for the technocratic center-right. But his first term was marked by intense political battles, in which his greatest nemesis and foil was a Democrat from South Bend, Indiana House Speaker Pat Bauer. Daniels' first major and controversial policy was to lease the Indiana Toll Road, which ran through our northern part of the state, to a private entity and use the money to finance road projects across Indiana. The privatization was unpopular here and fiercely opposed by the Democrats, led by the old-school Speaker Bauer. When the 75-year lease to a private operator went through, the flow of funds to other parts of the state felt to many here like a poke in the eye. Viewing Daniels about the same way most people in the area did, I had briefly worked for his 2008 opponent, taking a few weeks off from McKinsey to help with policy research, press, and debate preparation, a fact I hoped would not come to light while I was in the process of reaching out to him. But in working on his opponent's campaign, I also began to realize what had made Daniels a formidable opponent, and such a highly effective governor that some national conservatives saw him as their best hope of challenging President Obama. He was a business-minded technocrat, with very little interest in the social issues that were used to rile up electoral bases in campaign years, but left communities divided long after their political usefulness expired. Instead, he was extremely focused on economic issues and interested in making government work well, even achieving the improbable feat of reforming the Bureau of Motor Vehicles into an efficient and user-friendly customer service organization. Since the BMV is the one state office that virtually every citizen uses, it was also a politically clever thing to do. When I had been campaigning for mayor, a frequent gripe was that the state's Economic Development Agency had done virtually no deals in the South Bend area since Daniels had become governor. Blame went in all directions. Many believed that we were being punished, that because our northern region was far from Indianapolis and generally voted Democratic, the state government ignored us or even went out of its way to withhold opportunities from us. Others insisted that our woes were of our own making, that South Bend was so unfriendly to business and beholden to labor groups that it was impossible for even the best-intentioned Republican administration in Indianapolis to work with us. I didn't care whose fault it was, I just wanted it to change. And I sensed that the governor might feel the same way. I had no use for the Bush administration, of which he had been a part, and he would probably never agree with my full-throated support for public education and organized labor rights. But despite our differences in ideology, it seemed that he and I shared a desire to use data and good management practices to drive better government. And politically, it made sense for him to score economic wins anywhere in the state he could, including our area. Eager to work across party lines, I gathered some community and business leaders and invited him to lunch in South Bend. The meeting was genial, and afterward he made some flattering comments to the Tribune for a story that ran with the headline, "Governor Likes South Bend's New Attitude." We agreed that he and I should be working together to find opportunities, and sure enough, a few weeks later, Daniels was back in South Bend celebrating the expansion of a local steel box manufacturer with help from state incentives, and an end to the dry spell of state economic development wins in our region. It was my first major experience in this kind of bipartisan cooperation. The most important thing I learned was that it has little to do with stretching or changing your beliefs. The governor and I did not persuade one another to become more centrist on any particular issue. Rather, we found the areas where we had common goals and stuck to them. Plus, by collaborating on a specific, measured effort, we gained ground in trust and familiarity that would be helpful in the future. But Governor Daniels was in his final year, and I would have to start over again when the 2012 election yielded his successor. I had known of Congressman Mike Pence for years, since he was a highly visible figure among the conservative warriors in Republican leadership on Capitol Hill. So when I actually first met him, at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in 2011, I was surprised by how affable, even gentle, he seemed. I was with a group of candidates and elected officials attending the Indy 500, and it was a warm day at the Speedway. Then reality television personality Donald Trump had been set to drive the pace car that day, but had backed out for some unexplained reason. As we milled around near our seats, someone spotted Pence walking along the concourse to his box and introduced us. Dressed in the politician's off-duty uniform of a blue Oxford shirt and khakis, he very much looked the part, a congressman going to a sporting event. We exchanged some pleasantries, and I didn't think much of it, or expect to see him anytime soon. But a year and a half later, I was sitting in a folding chair in the January sun, facing the west front of the Indiana Capitol, at his invitation, looking through a cloud of my own breath as he took the oath of office and became Indiana's governor. Afterwards, at a reception for attendees, I caught up to him and mentioned my eagerness to work together to benefit the city. He gave a sincere nod and heartily agreed, and a long and complicated relationship began. There's a photo from that spring of 2013 showing me with Mike and Karen Pence in the MR Falcons Club on the west side of South Bend. The MRs, not to be confused with the ZB Falcons on the far west side, is one of those old-fashioned social halls and civic associations that long revolved around working-class civic commitment, neighborhood ties, and Polish identity, hence a major stop for the Dingus Day experience. Though Dingus Day, as I described earlier, has traditionally been a Democratic-focused affair, more Republicans have realized its value for mixing it up with regular voters. Responding to my invitation to come to town any time, the new governor and first lady had decided to experience the sausage, cabbage, and camaraderie firsthand. Unfortunately, his office was less responsive to my advice on exactly when to come during the day's festivities. Local politicians know from experience that it is best to conduct their Dingus Day activities as early as possible, since the beer, music, and sausage are already going strong at daybreak, and things only get more, well, festive over the course of the day. The Pences turned up in mid-afternoon, pretty much the peak of the day's eating and drinking. In the photo, I have my arm around the governor as if he were an old friend. I certainly sought to be a friendly host, but the main reason my hand was at his back was that I was trying urgently to get him out of that room. Not only were the revelers into their revelry, but worse, his detail had dropped him off at the entrance that led to the bar, full of some of our younger citizens taking advantage of beer specials, as opposed to the larger room containing the more elderly and sedate visitors enjoying their kielbasa and noodles. Retail politics is never fun among the intoxicated. If a voter who doesn't like you has had a lot to drink, you get an earful. It's even worse if a voter who does like you has been drinking. The handshakes last way too long, they begin repeating themselves, and it takes a well-practiced art to get away from them and move on to talk to someone else, which is futile anyway, since the same person will find you later and try to have the same conversation. So my immediate concern was to get the governor and first lady out of the bar and into the dining room before they regretted coming altogether. My arm was around him in order to push him, as quickly as a mayor politely could, into the other room. I don't know if it was because of that visit or in spite of it, but the governor seemed to remain determined to be a friend to South Bend. His office was always open to me, and he often appeared in our area for factory tours, ribbon cuttings, and other events, always with something good to say about our city. He even appointed Jim Schellinger, a well-known Democrat and architect originally from South Bend, to chair the Indiana Economic Development Corporation. Most helpfully, Pence championed a visionary economic development effort called the Regional Cities Initiative, which helped change how we position our cities for growth. The basic idea behind regional cities was that economic development is no longer just a game of luring factories, what some call smokestack chasing, from other locations, using tax incentives essentially to buy jobs. Instead, at a time when many people first choose where they want to live and then start looking for a job, it makes sense to recruit people, not just employers. The best way to do that is to enhance the appeal of the community, often called quality of place. And the initiative's focus was on supporting projects that would do just that. The other main idea of the Regional Cities Program was that communities in the same area should work together. For years, cities and towns would view their immediate neighbors as economic rivals, trying to lure jobs across a city limit or county line. But since many workers commute across these boundaries anyway, it does no good to add jobs at the expense of the next town over. If South Bend focused on picking off employers from nearby Elkhart, it wouldn't matter much to the regional economy. Using tax incentives to achieve this would simply give away revenue while rearranging economic value within the same area. Sensibly, some metro areas have entered into economic non-aggression pacts, in which each city promises not to use incentives to lure employers away from its neighbors. But true regional collaboration, proactively working with other cities by sharing resources to grow the economy, was still rare in Indiana. To incentivize better behavior, the state offered a major grant for local economic development work, not to a city, but to a region. In order to compete for the funding, all the counties and cities in an area would have to band together, show they could collaborate, and submit a joint application showing how they would share the funds. We competed for the grant and won a $42 million package of state matching funds to help with projects in our area that ranged from accelerating the electric train to Chicago to enhancing parks and trails along the river. I viewed it as a great policy by the state, not just because we were happy to have the funding, but because the focus on regionalism and quality of place helped improve the habits of local leaders and economic development players. One spring day in 2016, I attended a press event in a former Studebaker factory being renovated into a technology center with help from the state program. Inside a vast, empty space with high brick walls and broken windows, civic and business leaders gathered around the dream of a different economy, perhaps even a Silicon Prairie of data centers in our part of the Midwest. I described the governor's signature program as visionary and thanked him for the work he had done to make it happen. After I returned to my seat, Pence rose and spoke generously about me and our city. Quote, "South Bend, Indiana is so blessed to have an energetic, innovative, forward-looking, creative mayor in Pete Buttigieg," end quote. There was plenty to disagree on, as with Mitch Daniels, but once again I hoped that we could stick to common ground. While I objected to Pence's handling of early childhood education funding, labor policy, refugee resettlement, and several other issues, I saw other opportunities to work together on promoting growth. If Mike Pence had kept his primary focus on economic development, our mutual desire to work across the aisle could have anchored a bipartisan friendship that might continue to this day. Then again, if he had stuck with economics, he would probably still be governor and would never have become vice president. By the time Pence came to our area to celebrate the regional cities funding, working with him had become, for me, a demanding exercise in compartmentalization. I knew that he held the keys to economic policies that would advance our city's interests and our region's growth. But he had also revealed himself to be gripped by hard-right social ideology in ways that would make even my old rival, Richard Murdoch, look moderate. It was part of my job to work well with anyone who could help the city. But Pence's fanaticism was hard to overlook, knowing how it had impacted me as a mayor and as a person. There was a basic fact about Mike Pence that made him deeply different from his predecessor, Daniels, and, for that matter, his successor, Eric Holcomb, even if all three were committed Republicans. Pence was fixated on social issues. However they felt about these matters, Daniels and Holcomb were generally strategic enough to keep them in the background while focusing on more tangible gains that could make the state better off. Whatever partisan gain they might have secured by playing to their base with red meat on issues like abortion and LGBT equality, they mostly concentrated on the kind of consensus policies that mayors and cities appreciate most, like economic development or road funding. Pence, by contrast, could not limit himself to these issues. Maybe it had to do with the years he had spent in Congress, where the Washington environment rewards and punishes various behaviors very differently than for executive branch leaders. He had made his name in the House as a partisan warrior specializing in anti-abortion and anti-LGBT legislation, and even challenged John Boehner from the right for the position of minority leader in 2006. Perhaps this instinct was hard to shake off as he transitioned to becoming a governor. Or maybe it's just who he is, a deeply conservative politician who had shifted from Catholicism to evangelical Christianity as a young man, and has described himself as Christian, conservative, and Republican in that order. Business leaders and mayors in Indiana had hoped that, after leaving Congress, as a governor now and a rumored presidential aspirant, he might ease up on divisive social issues and focus on concrete results for the state. But, given his makeup, perhaps a divisive cultural clash was just a matter of time. When Mike Pence told me and a few other Democratic and Republican mayors that he was planning to sign the proposed Religious Freedom Restoration Act because it was, quote, in my heart that it's the right thing to do, end quote, I believed him. Not that it was the right thing to do, of course, but that this was in his heart. We weren't there to talk about religious freedom, gay rights, or any other social issue. As president of the Indiana Urban Mayors Caucus, I had come with a small delegation of mayors from around the state, mainly to try to get movement on road funding and make sure the legislature wouldn't interfere with our ability to use tax increment financing for economic development. In the large wood-paneled room that is the Indiana governor's office, he hosted us graciously, warmly greeting each mayor as we stepped onto the blue carpet and saying something nice to each of us as we took a seat at his long conference table. We reviewed local priorities like tax issues and progress on the regional cities effort. And then, as the meeting ended, he changed the subject to the proposed bill. I wish I could say I made a good effort to talk him out of it, but it was clear from the look in his eyes that he had made up his mind. It was also clear that he had no idea what a backlash the bill could provoke, not just from progressives, but also from business-oriented Republicans. The language of the bill seemed innocent enough. Quote, a governmental entity may not substantially burden a person's exercise of religion, end quote, unless there is a compelling governmental interest at stake. But person was defined to include companies, building on the legal theory of the 2014 Supreme Court Hobby Lobby case, which interpreted federal law as giving corporations the same religious rights as people. Effectively, this meant that any place of business, from a restaurant to an auto mechanic shop, could refuse to serve an LGBT individual or couple, provided its owner cited religion as the motivation for discriminating. It could even be interpreted to protect an EMT or physician denying care to a gay patient. And it would wipe out South Bend's own local ordinance, passed in 2012, which prohibited workplace and housing discrimination against LGBT residents. Despite the name, its purpose was not to restore religious freedom. After all, religious freedom is already guaranteed in the Constitution. The bill's actual purpose, its sponsors would later reveal, was to legalize discrimination. On March 25, 2015, a photograph appeared showing Governor Pence, seated at his desk in that same office where he had met with our little group of mayors, signing the Religious Freedom Restoration Act into law. Surrounding him was an anachronistic-looking group of nuns in habits, monks in cloaks, and other figures in religious garb, as well as a few men in suits whom reporters quickly recognized as the best-known anti-LGBT political activists in Indiana. The bill he signed amid that assemblage would remain intact for all of 1 week before Pence was forced to change course. And the national controversy he detonated from that stately desk would simultaneously destroy his credibility with many American moderates and set him on an improbable path to the vice presidency. The effect on our economic image was immediate and destructive. Pence had set the Silicon Prairie on fire. Until then, Indiana had managed to create a reputation as a somewhat forward-looking place to do business, thanks to a fiscally disciplined state government, low taxes, and livable communities. A nascent tech sector in South Bend was reanimating the once moribund Studebaker corridor with data centers and startups. In Indianapolis, recruiting educated talent was paramount as its life sciences sector grew and was joined by a number of internet companies drawn to the favorable business environment. Our state was known to be a little old-fashioned. Until 2018, it remained unlawful here to buy alcohol from a store on Sundays. But the growth in Indiana cities had started to make our state look like an appealingly modern place for people to build jobs, lives, and families. If anything, we had created a sense that Indiana was a place where homespun tradition and cultural modernity might coexist, like the hipster selling small-batch chocolate in a stall next to the old farmer with his eggs and pickles at the farmer's market in South Bend. Part of the appeal of our state was that you could work up an appetite visiting covered bridges or attending a truck pull in Owen County, then fill up on farm-to-table pub food at Upland Brewery, half an hour away in Bloomington. Add in the lower taxes and cost of living, and we could even set our sights on luring young professionals from Chicago and elsewhere who were looking for a vibrant but more livable place to put down roots. Nothing could be more fatal to this image than for our state to become known as a place that sanctioned discrimination. To many, it called to mind the ugliest demons of our state's past, hearkening back to the days a century earlier when the Indiana branch of the Ku Klux Klan became the most powerful political force in our state, with half the members of the Indiana State Legislature on its rolls, largely based on a message that emphasized social issues like gambling, adultery, and prohibition. Horrified mayors from both parties swiftly joined business leaders to denounce the bill. Greg Ballard, the Republican mayor of Indianapolis, joined four predecessors, going all the way back to Dick Lugar, in a statement that they were, quote, distressed and very concerned, end quote, about the law. The CEOs of our most significant companies, from the engine maker Cummins to the tech firm Angie's List, put out similar messages. The story quickly went national. On Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update, RFRA was the top story, with Colin Jost joking that any company taking advantage of the right to discriminate would be easily recognized by a going-out-of-business sign. The fallout accelerated through the week. The NCAA signaled it might drop Indiana as a venue for major events, and even NASCAR put out a statement that it was, quote, disappointed. One of the newest major employers for the Indianapolis region, Salesforce.com, said it would cancel a major planned expansion into Indiana. And, denouncing, quote, outright bigotry in Indiana, end quote, the governor of Connecticut went as far as to ban his employees from traveling to our state on taxpayer funds. The next Sunday morning, I was barefoot in sweatpants at home, watching TV before getting dressed for the day's events. A beleaguered-looking Pence appeared on This Week with George Stephanopoulos, trying to reassure a national audience that the bill was not about discrimination. The interview was a disaster. When Stephanopoulos asked, quote, do you think it should be legal in the state of Indiana to discriminate against gays or lesbians, end quote, Pence paused and winced. George, he began, then sighed. It's a yes or no question, Stephanopoulos pressed. Look, Hoosiers, come on, the governor stammered in an almost pleading tone. Hoosiers don't believe in discrimination. Still trying to get a yes or no answer, Stephanopoulos asked the question again, and then again. No matter how many times he was asked, Pence would not simply say that the answer was no, which means he probably believed the answer was yes, but at least knew not to admit it. One national columnist later described it as, quote, very possibly one of the worst appearances by a governor in television history, end quote. The rest of the day, I tried in the back of my mind to reconcile what I had just seen on screen with the Mike Pence I knew, a man who had always been gracious and decent to me in person, and eager to cooperate on economic matters. Most of my interactions with Republican politicians were exercises in coming to view someone more charitably, building understanding, goodwill, and appreciation as we acknowledged our differences and sought common ground. This time, the reverse was true, as I watched someone I felt I knew well go on to embarrass himself and our whole state. We all knew that the governor was very conservative, and his policy positions on any social issue were rarely a surprise. But was he really incapable of saying, even pretending, that he believed discrimination should not be legal? My own moral outrage compounded the fact that he had just made my job, as a mayor intent on growing our community as an inclusive and welcoming place, more difficult. We suddenly appeared backward by association, along with every other community in the state. The bill would preempt local laws, like our local non-discrimination ordinance, and send a message that people living in our city could not expect to be treated equally. Notre Dame, which competes in recruiting not just with other colleges but with other college towns, would have a harder time selling South Bend. If Memorial Hospital needed to attract a specialist in pediatric cancer, or I needed to get a brilliant policy specialist to come work for the city, the state's reputation would be a new hurdle. And it wasn't just about high-flying educated experts who might turn their nose up at our state's license to discriminate. It was also a blow to some of our most vulnerable residents, like a teenager at one of our high schools, already in the incredibly difficult process of facing her sexuality or gender identity, now being told that the state would not protect her rights. Jay Leno threatened to cancel an upcoming show here. Our Convention and Visitors Bureau director, Rob DeClean, fought back tears at a community meeting a few days after the bill passed, insisting that he would continue to try to show that our city was a welcoming place. the alarmed director of our Studebaker National Museum, forwarded me an email from one of her top donors, indicating he would likely remove the museum from his will. "I don't for a minute suggest that the museum is complicitous," he wrote, "but I do feel it is up to every individual and institution in the state to make a stand against this kind of bigotry." The only way to avoid South Bend getting lumped in with the rest of the state was to be vocal. Soon I was standing in a downtown diner for a quickly assembled news conference with a number of civic voices. The diversity of the group spoke for itself. An activist with dyed orange hair, a Navy veteran, the president of our baseball team, a Jewish grandmother, and the CEO of a locally based insurance company all stood at my side as I sought to reassure members of the LGBT community that they were safe in South Bend, and called on the state to reverse course. My office distributed stickers reading, "Come on in, South Bend is an open city," and they quickly began appearing in restaurant and shop windows across town. Businesses from the South Bend Brew Works to the Blackthorn Golf Club signed up on a list of companies reaffirming their commitment to serve all. And I found myself on national TV and radio discussing just the kind of national social issue that had rarely been on my plate as mayor. Like all furors, this one, too, had its comic dimensions. In Walkerton, about half an hour from South Bend, the owner of a place called Memories Pizza answered a question from a local TV reporter and unexpectedly became the first Indiana business person to suggest publicly that he'd use the law to avoid catering a gay wedding. The internet erupted with angry responses, largely in the form of zero-star Yelp reviews. The content of the posts ranged from simple outrage to obscene images composed of pizza toppings to expressions of puzzlement over what circumstances would lead a gay couple to ask a rural pizza place to cater their wedding in the first place. Late night TV had a field day, with Michael Keaton playing the pizza owner on Saturday Night Live, turning away customers with a wagged finger in a goofy spoof of CNN's reporting style. The reaction quickly went over the top, with threats to burn the place down prompting them to close for a few days, not something likely to inspire the owners toward a more forward-looking attitude on tolerance and equality. As things grew more fierce, I began to feel a kind of regret for the owner and his adult daughter, who probably had no idea that their unguarded words to a local camera crew would make them a national lightning rod. But I needn't have worried about them. They set up a GoFundMe.com page to cover the costs of their closure and promptly raised $800,000. The entire property of Memories Pizza, including the land and the building, had been assessed at around $40,000 in value. Only in America in 2015 could a small-town pizza provider profess prejudice in the name of Christianity before a local TV crew, be mocked around the country on late-night television, and then be made rich beyond belief all in a matter of days. "Indiana pizza better be good effing pizza, that's all I can say," John Stewart opined in disbelief. As I watched all this unfold, my mind turned to the people I knew, older conservatives mostly, who were on the road to acceptance of LGBT equality but had sincere difficulty in getting there. What would my next-door neighbors think of all this? If my grandmother, who had voted for Reagan but been turned off by Gingrich, were living, would the contours of this debate make her more or less likely to embrace equality? How could we make it clear that there was no going back on equality, without seeming so ferocious to these citizens that we pushed them straight back into the arms of the religious right? The swift social change was exhilarating, but its suddenness would disorient many Americans, which increased the risk of backlash. As New York Times columnist Frank Bruni noted, a 64-year-old Southern woman, not on board with marriage equality, finds herself characterized as a hateful boob, never mind that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton weren't themselves on board just 5 short years ago. But amid the divisiveness, the RFRA debate actually helped to bring people together across traditional party lines. Because the law's endorsement of discrimination was so naked and harmful, it aroused opposition from conservatives, who may have struggled with something like marriage equality, but at least recognized that it's wrong to mistreat someone because of who they are or whom they love. The activism of longtime progressives and LGBT advocates was crucial, but I believe it was ultimately the revolt of the business Republicans that changed the course of this debate. On March 31st, 5 days after the bill passed, the often conservative Indianapolis Star carried a rare front-page editorial, headlined in letters so big they almost took up the entire page, "Fix This Now." By the time the video of Pence's disastrous This Week appearance was ricocheting across the internet, it was clear that the bill was untenable in its current form. Desperate to stanch the reputational bleeding, the Republican State Assembly hastily composed a clarification to the law, specifying that it could not be used to justify discrimination. The bill's original backers complained loudly that this clarification defeated the whole purpose of the bill, which was true and revealing. Their objection exposed the deep truth that, contrary to Pence's protestations, discrimination had been at the heart of their project all along. The so-called fix was not exactly a leap forward in LGBT inclusion. An effort failed the next year to actually establish a civil rights policy, which meant going forward that in many parts of Indiana, people could still be fired for being gay. Embarrassingly, we also remained one of just 5 American states with no ban on hate crimes. But the whole episode showed that trying to appeal to radical social conservatives no longer worked in Indiana, because it would run afoul of what most people believed, including typically conservative groups like the business community. The controversy crippled Pence's reputation as governor and created an opening for his Democratic challenger, John Gregg, to mount a credible campaign against him for the governor's office in 2016. What no one could have known then was the future benefit to Pence of establishing himself as a hero to the religious far right, a political martyr almost. It made him into a brilliant, if cynical, choice of running mate for Donald Trump. Nominating an evangelical heartland governor was the best way for a thrice-married, formerly pro-choice, philandering ex-Democrat like Trump to reach out to religious conservatives and begin unifying the fractured right around his candidacy. And while Trump's life story was anathema to everything Mike Pence believed in, this was the right move for Pence, too, if viewed in the cynical light of raw politics. The governor had lost respect on both sides of the aisle in his home state, and was now widely expected to lose his re-election. Strange bedfellows though they were, Mike Pence and Donald Trump needed each other. Win or lose, teaming up with Trump could give Pence a second political life. Chapter 13. Hitting Home. It was mild and hazy on the morning of June 1st, 2016, as I stood on the tarmac waiting for Air Force One. I had shown up for what I thought would be a perfunctory handshake and photo opportunity. President Obama was to speak in Elkhart, about 40 minutes east of South Bend's airport, which was the nearest place where you could land a 747. As mayor, I would have the honor of welcoming him as he stepped off the plane and walked over to the limousine. Standing alongside Senator Donnelly and the president of the county commissioners as the jumbo jet descended for its final approach, it was easy to be awed by the spectacle of America's presidential security apparatus. As soon as the big aircraft landed, chase vehicles appeared on the runway, seemingly from nowhere, SUVs racing along its side for some reason as it slowed to a taxi. Innumerable Secret Service and military personnel crowded the apron as the mighty white and blue aircraft swung around. Off to the side was a C-17. It had probably delivered the limo earlier, along with who knows what military equipment and personnel, to be at the president's side just in case. I thought of the day in 1988 when my father took me to peer through the chain-link fence at Ronald Reagan's plane and reflected on the nature of American strength as symbolized by the big jet, the vehicles, the personnel. The arrival of a presidential aircraft is somewhat light on ceremony, but heavy on equipment and personnel, less a show of elegance than one of power. In a sense, it was also proof of the great faith and optimism shown by our cautious founders in placing this much authority in the hands of one democratically elected human being. Imagine the implications, I thought, as I eyed the SUVs, the security men, the big gray-tail military jet in the distance, if all this were to fall into the hands of someone unfit to wield it. The president descended the familiar staircase, did his requisite handshaking with the 3 of us smiling officials, and walked past us to greet a small gaggle of locals who had been invited for one reason or another to view the landing from the tarmac. Then, an aide tapped me on the shoulder and asked me to step toward the limo nearby. Moments later, I was sitting inside, facing backward, and looking eye to eye at a smiling Barack Obama. I glanced down to make sure my feet did not accidentally tap the president's shoes. President Obama was in a buoyant mood. "How are the Irish looking for this fall?" he asked me, and Senator Donnelly, seated next to him. The conversation hovered on football for a while, then ranged through what was happening in South Bend, how the auto industry had come back, how our city was positioning itself relative to the economy of Chicago. It was not a business session, though at one point Obama turned to Donnelly and pointedly mentioned that he needed the Senate to come through with funding for his opioid package. We compared stories on throwing out the first pitch. Admittedly a little different at a South Bend Cubs game than opening day at Nationals Park, but it was nice to be able to have something in common, sort of, with the president. He volunteered that one of the moments when he truly admired his predecessor was when Bush, not long after the 9/11 attacks, nailed a perfect strike in his first pitch at Game 3 of the World Series at Yankee Stadium. Wishing for the first time in my life that the commute to Elkhart along the US 20 bypass could somehow grow longer, I alternated between enjoying the conversation and disbelieving that it was happening in the first place. I felt I was comporting myself reasonably well, taking the opportunity to explain what was happening in our city and what our greatest needs were for support. Then, after the conversation had turned to something about my time in Afghanistan, the president interrupted me to ask, "Wait a minute, how old are you anyway?" And for what felt like a minute, I had no idea. A few weeks earlier, I had met, for the first time, the person most of us assumed would be the next president. Chasten and I were at my parents' place for Sunday night dinner, as usual, when a phone call came from a friend involved with the Clinton campaign. Hillary wants to do a campaign event in northern Indiana. Could we find a good place for her to speak? She would be here on Tuesday. I knew right away where to send her. AM General, one of the largest employers in our community, had a great story to tell. Best known for producing Humvees for the military, it had also manufactured a number of commercial vehicles, including the well-known Hummer line and the MV1, a new kind of vehicle for people with disabilities. Moreover, the company demonstrated how to keep with the times in ways that had escaped Studebaker. The company was in the midst of a 3-year contract to manufacture Mercedes R-Class vehicles, a luxury SUV sold exclusively in the Chinese market. Here was a brilliant example of how American workers could play a role, other than victim, in the globalized economy. Right in our part of the industrial Midwest, we had American union auto workers building a German-branded vehicle shipped to customers in Asia. I made, as they say, a few phone calls. 2 days later, I was in a folding chair on the factory floor watching Secretary Clinton give her stump speech to the assembled auto workers and various chosen community members in attendance after a tour on the shop floor. It all went as it was supposed to, except for one oddity at the end, which amounts in retrospect to a major warning sign. Polite applause. After Clinton spoke, everyone clapped in their seats. Then she shook hands along a rope line and was off to the next event. This might sound normal, but I had been at enough campaign events over the years to know that a presidential campaign appearance this late in the game should never end with anything but people on their feet. At the time, it just struck me as a little peculiar that a union-heavy and typically Democratic crowd was not standing to cheer. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, it looks like a sign of her campaign's fatal lack of enthusiasm among workers in the industrial Midwest. Other candidates had plenty of energy and motivation that spring, and they brought it with them to South Bend. On consecutive days in May, our Century Center downtown saw visits from Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. The venue was the same, but atmospheres around these two visits could not have been more different. Mingling with the folks in line around the Century Center parking lot to see Bernie, I felt like I was at a party, or maybe a rock concert. Attendees were clearly serious about their values, but had also come with a cheerful, even playful spirit. Walking up and down alongside the line to get in, hangers-on hawked Feel the Burn t-shirts and buttons picturing the hair and glasses, Bernie with the finch, Bernie riding a unicorn. The next day's Trump rally felt like a party too, but one of those edgy parties where you're not totally sure if a fight will break out. Bernie had drawn about 4,200 spectators to his event. The Trump crowd was over 10,000. As the rallygoers waited all afternoon to get in, protesters lined up to face them across St. Joseph Street, soon to be renamed for Dr. King. There had been enough cases of violence around other recent Trump rallies that I was worried. Our safety strategy was twofold. Publicly, I focused on calling the community to its highest values, telling a TV crew from WNDU, "We welcome anybody who's here to express their free speech rights, even if we have vigorous disagreements. I expect the community to demonstrate our values of welcome and inclusion when it comes to responding to this campaign's arrival." Behind the scenes, I wanted to leave nothing to chance and asked our police department to be as vigilant as possible without undercutting the freedom of attendees and protesters. Police set up a temporary command post in a nearby building, overlooking the area, tracking online threats of violence and eyeing the parking lot for trouble. Visiting, both to thank the officers and gauge the temperature of our first responders, I passed a huddle of fully geared-up SWAT officers, there just in case, and reflected on how suddenly times had changed. This was not what it had been like when Harry Truman's whistle-stop tour came through, or Reagan or Obama, for that matter. For the first time in the modern life of South Bend, a mayor had to approach the arrival of a major presidential campaign in his city primarily through a sobering lens, not that of civic pride or even partisan politics, but rather the possibility of political violence. Accustomed to sizing up presidential rallies for their political impact, I now had to approach this one mainly from the perspective of safety. The rally itself was in keeping with most of the others. Nothing happened that was particularly unusual by the standards of that spring. Trump was close to clinching the nomination, and his speech contained all of the greatest hits that he would repeat throughout the summer and fall. He promised to build a wall, and that Mexico would pay for it. He took jabs at his rivals, from Hillary Clinton to Ted Cruz. He attacked free trade and globalization, and vowed to deliver the most successful presidency ever. "We're going to win so much, you're going to beg me, Mr. President, please, please, it's too much winning." As a mayor, my idea of winning that day simply consisted of getting through the afternoon without incident. Checking in periodically for signs of trouble, I was reassured by our police department that the rallygoers and protesters were keeping it peaceful, if passionate. The day's last situation report from the police chief let me finally breathe a sigh of relief. No injuries, no arrests. The Clinton and Trump campaigns swapped fortunes repeatedly, up and down, through the summer. The last few days were marked by uptight but sincere confidence on the part of the Hillary campaign, mixed with a widespread sense that she was nowhere near as strong as she should be. The County City Building is an early vote site, and as I crossed the lobby on my way to the office each morning in those last few days before the election, I wondered if this would be a close one even in our county. With its strong blue-collar tradition, St. Joseph County is normally one of the most Democratic in a mostly Republican state. But when Election Day came, she won our county only by a hair, a sign of major underperformance overall. In the elevator the next day, I greeted my colleague, Christina Brooks, and saw her face wet with tears. When we got to my floor, the staff looked bewildered. I called a staff meeting, telling everyone around the table that the most important element of our job had just become more difficult and more pressing, to hold the community together. Christina then described the experience of trying to reassure her daughter that it would be safe to go to school that morning. When her daughter showed her KKK-themed social media memes that her classmates were sending her that night while joking about Trump's victory, she thought of her own upbringing as an African-American woman and realized it wasn't just her daughter she was trying to reassure. It was herself. Another colleague, Sherry Pete, said she feared for her brother simply because he was a tall, young black man. Was he in more danger now? And also, exactly what was it this new president was promising our country? Make America great again, she asked, looking around the room as if any of us could make it less threatening for her. When was America ever great for us? Later that day, I went to meet with the College Democrats chapter at Notre Dame. Some of them were also tearful, and for many of them, this was personal. Grace, the student co-president, who was a survivor and an outspoken advocate on campus sexual assault, described the effect this was having on students in a similar situation. She had gone, concerned, to check on one student she knew who was struggling with the ways the election had compounded the trauma of her own assault, and found her suicidal. Life went on, but it began to be punctuated by interventions from national politics of a kind I had not seen before. One day, my phone started to blow up with texts asking if there was any truth to rumors of an ICE raid on the West Side. I asked around to see if there was something going on. There wasn't, but by the time I knew that for sure, several of the small businesses in the Latino-heavy west side of our city had shut down for the day, and families were taking refuge in St. Adalbert's Church. Stepping into St. Adalbert's, you were immediately struck by its magnificent proportions for a church in the middle of a neighborhood. It was built in 1926 with the original intent of becoming a cathedral, only for the diocese to decide to seat the bishop elsewhere in what many considered to be a snub of the Polish immigrant community. On one interior wall, a mural depicts Christ with the background of immigrants beating swords into plowshares. An inscription above his figure reads in Polish, by the sweat of your brow, you have earned the bread of life. Nearly a century later, it's still the spiritual home to large Catholic immigrant working families, only now they mostly speak Spanish, not Polish. Father Ibarra has succeeded predecessors with names like Gabczynski and Kazmierczak. And in this first scare of the Trump era, it now became a haven for families unsure if they were safe in their own workplaces or homes. Parents had grabbed their kids from Harrison Primary Center, and small shops closed for the day. After that day, working the phones to verify this was all a false alarm, my staff and I added to our mayor's office to-do list the creation of a phone tree in the event of immigration raids. One evening, soon after, I walked through the doors of the Harrison School, a place I sometimes visited in order to read to second graders. This time, I wasn't there to introduce them to Pete the Cat, but to address a Know Your Rights event for neighborhood residents. Hushed voices of hundreds of parents echoed off the lacquered basketball floor of the gym where they gathered. A legal nonprofit had set up a projector with a slideshow. I rose to reassure the parents, in my rusty high school Spanish, that we were a welcoming community. Our police are here to keep you safe, not to practice federal immigration enforcement, I insisted. And not to tear your family apart, I thought. The last thing our law enforcement needed was for Latino families to be afraid even to speak to our officers, especially if they had information needed to solve or prevent crime in their neighborhoods, all because they conflate local police with federal immigration authorities. As I got ready to leave, a volunteer came up to me in the hall of the school and said there were some high school kids who wanted to meet me. I wasn't sure why high school kids would be around, since Harrison is an elementary school, but I said I'd be happy to, and followed her into the glass-walled school library. There, I saw a group of mostly white students from Adams High School, which is over on the east side. One was helping a group of small kids figure out a puzzle. Another was distributing pepperoni pizza from boxes lined up on the side. A student explained that they were volunteering as part of their National Honor Society commitment, entertaining children while their parents were in the gym. I choked up with a mix of emotions. Appreciation on one hand for the work of these civically spirited students, and on the other hand, alarm at the world we were living in. When I was in high school NHS, our volunteer projects had to do with things like litter cleanup. Now, in post-2016 America, there were whole new categories of things you can volunteer to do, such as consoling and entertaining six-year-olds while their terrified immigrant parents gather in a school gym to get legal advice on how to keep their families from being torn apart by federal agents. It was another reminder that the reality of politics is personal, not theoretical. Tip O'Neill's dictum was right. All politics is local, especially national politics. For me, the politics of immigration came even more up close and personal when I visited Eddie's Steak Shed to meet the family and friends of its owner, Roberto Beristain. Roberto had been a fixture in nearby Granger, and so was Eddie's, employing about 20 people. He had come to the U.S. 20 years earlier, without a visa, and fallen in love with an American citizen named Helen, whom he would marry. He got a job as a cook at Helen's family restaurant, and eventually saved up enough to buy out his retiring brother-in-law. He and Helen were raising three kids, all citizens. He had been trying, himself, to become a citizen for years, but his path was complicated by a years-old paperwork problem from being detained at the Canadian border during a vacation to Niagara Falls. Still, he had a work permit and a driver's license, he paid taxes, and for years had been visiting an ICE office annually to check in. Other than immigrating without permission, he was more law-abiding than most of us, with not so much as a traffic ticket against his name. Every year, Roberto would go check in with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. But when he went to an ICE office to renew his work permit in February 2017, things did not go as usual. At this gathering of alarmed friends and family members, who had asked me to come meet them at the restaurant a couple hours before it opened, Helen teared up as she described waiting for him in the car outside, growing more and more concerned until someone came out to tell her that Roberto was being detained. By the time I came to meet Helen and their friends, Roberto was being held for deportation in Racine, Wisconsin. Procedurally, things were not looking good for him. His lawyers had few options. Still, the friends and family at the restaurant took turns making his case and sharing stories about him. A server spoke of how hard he worked alongside his staff, in the kitchen when necessary. His stepson explained how Roberto held up his family. One by one, they described what he meant to them and asked me what could be done. Demographically, the crowd was typical of Granger, overwhelmingly white and Republican. Yet they were all outraged that their hard-working and honest friend was being taken away. I recognized one man, with a small white mustache and a light-colored blazer, from a Kiwanis Club appearance I had made nearby. He was a certain kind of old-school, dignified, small-town gentleman for whom being Republican was synonymous with being respectable, someone who likely voted for Trump without enthusiasm but out of reflex, reinforced by a decades-long antipathy to all things Clinton. He grew indignant as he described how he and his conservative friends expected the new president to go after criminals, not members of the community in good standing. It emerged that even Helen had voted for Trump, never expecting this. I had little role other than to listen. A mayor can't do much when it comes to immigration policy. I ached for some way to reassure the family, especially the two bright teenage daughters who were now dealing with a new dimension of bullying in middle school. Your father is illegal. And their 8-year-old brother, Dimitri, who simply didn't understand why his dad wasn't there to put him to bed anymore. The more I spoke with the people there, the more I realized it was not necessarily a contradiction for conservatives to be upset about the detention and looming deportation of their friendly restaurant-owning neighbor. As I wrote later in a reflection for the Huffington Post, think of the favorite themes of conservatism: hard work, small business ownership, suspicion of overbearing government, and support for family. Each one of those themes is at stake here, and each is insulted by the prospect of a person like Roberto being ripped away from his business, friends, wife, and children by a federal agency. It was because, not in spite, of their conservatism that this roomful of people felt the need to stand up for this undocumented immigrant they knew. They also viewed his case differently because they actually knew him as a person, not as a stock character. Over time, I've observed that we are more generous, supportive, and pleasant toward people we actually know than toward those we understand only as categories or groups. Humans can, of course, be cruel in person, too. But as a general rule, we seem less likely to hate from up close. This explains the many people I've encountered who are noticeably racist in general, but deeply supportive and protective of minority individuals they actually know personally. And it explains the sudden expansion of LGBT freedom in this country, as people began to realize that the vilified category in question applied to specific people they already knew and loved. This kind of empathy was on display at Eddie's Steak Shed, as I looked at the dozens of signatures on a petition started by employees at the restaurant titled "Bring Our Boss Home." And I saw it in letters from people like the one who wrote, quote, "I voted for President Trump because I believed he was promising to develop a process to remove the illegal immigrants that have done acts against the United States. I also believed that he was going to correct the red tape that blocks the immigrants from becoming a citizen that have been a positive contributor to the way of life here," end quote, meaning immigrants like Roberta. As the story gained increasing attention, including a feature on 60 Minutes, many people responded judgmentally toward anyone, especially Helen, who could vote for Trump and then be surprised by this sort of outcome. But to do so is to assume that voting is about ideology and policy analysis, rather than identity and environment. For a hard-working and devoted woman like Helen, with a small family business in a conservative Indiana community, most of the people she dealt with, neighbors, customers, and acquaintances, were people for whom voting Republican was simply a matter of course. If she was also a consumer of conservative news on television and social media, more liberal messages might never have reached her in the first place. We should not be so surprised that she was so surprised. The outcome was as feared. Roberto was deported to Juarez, and the family lost the restaurant. The news cycle moved on. But it's hard for me to move beyond that singular moment at the restaurant as I prepared to leave, looking into Dimitri's eyes and trying to think of something to tell him besides "you'll get your father back" or "everything will be okay," which I could not say because I doubted it was true. Here was a kid, a very American kid, who wanted the most natural thing in the world, the company of his own father. And because of politics, he couldn't have it. A law said that he and his father were not of the same country, and a series of decisions meant that they could not live together. This, not some trading of rhetorical points on CNN or electoral up and down, is where political choices hit home. Not at the polling place itself, or a campaign rally, or in the halls of Congress, but in the eyes of a bewildered and utterly innocent 8-year-old boy. Section 6. Becoming. Think you're escaping and run into yourself. Longest way round is the shortest way home. James Joyce. Chapter 14. Dirt Sailor.
Sir, I asked, could you help me figure out how to answer this one on the form?
Lieutenant Murray looked annoyed. He often looked annoyed, though over time I would learn that his deadpan style concealed a kind of gruff affection for rather clueless junior officers like myself, along with the enlisted people he oversaw and the Navy overall. It was time to fill in the annual Reserve Screening Questionnaire, or RSQ, not to be confused with the Officer Qualification Questionnaire, OQQ, or Navy Reserve Qualification Questionnaire, the NRQQ, of course. Service in the Reserve will always be one of the highlights of my life, but the price of admission was an ongoing flow of administrativia. A reservist needs to be as bureaucratically healthy as an active duty service member, but has only 2 days a month to take care of the various requirements. The result is that during the monthly drills that make up much of your service, half of your time on base consists of filling out forms, undergoing medical checkups, running physical fitness tests, and clicking through computer-based training on everything from sexual harassment to cybersecurity. Whatever time is left over goes to production, doing a job resembling what you would theoretically do if you were called up, which in my case meant analyzing intelligence for the European command. The sooner I could update this form, along with all the other ensigns and junior lieutenants seated in the carpeted and windowless room at Fort Sheridan, the sooner I could get in the back, that is, the area full of classified computers, to do some actual work. The hang-up was that there was a question on this particular form pertaining to whether I could readily be deployed, which, of course, is the whole point of having a reserve. The question was short, but not simple. Are you considered a key employee in your civilian workplace? I wasn't sure what to say. This is mainly for firefighters and other first responders, Lieutenant Murray said, eyeing me through his glasses. Why, where do you work? I said what I usually said around the base when conversation went to our civilian day jobs. I work for the city. All right, can anyone else do your job?
Not exactly.
Are you the mayor? He asked sarcastically. It turns out that the answer to the question of being a key employee, in my case, was no. The reason is that under Indiana law for a city our size, a deputy mayor can be assigned to perform a mayor's duties if he or she gets called into active duty. There's even a specific part of Indiana statute contemplating this situation, dating back to 1865 when, perhaps, lawmakers envisioned a mayor raising a volunteer regiment to go fight at the tail end of the Civil War. So, as far as the Navy was concerned, I was not indispensable back home and thus fair game for deployment orders. This seemed reasonable to me. Every reservist leaves something important behind when called to active duty. Not only a job, as I had, but often a spouse and children, which I did not. Checking the box no was a humbling reminder that national defense has little regard for peacetime civilian hierarchy, which in a way was refreshing as well. All through my campaigns and my first year as mayor, I continued my regular reserve duties, usually driving 2 hours for a drill weekend in Illinois. Working 8-hour days, a relaxing contrast from my day job, and spending time with sailors from all walks of civilian life was a healthy antidote to the all-absorbing work I had in South Bend. By law, I could not engage in politics or perform civil duties during the 48 hours a month, plus 2 weeks a year, that I was active. It was a forced but welcome change of pace from the constant activity of being mayor. And there was even something welcome about being a more junior employee for a while, rather than the boss. Back home, I was responsible for the conduct of 1,000 employees and the well-being of 100,000 residents. On drill weekends, I was responsible for my own paperwork and that of a handful of sailors and soldiers assigned to my branch. Deployments are part of the bargain for reservists, but so is dwell time, the idea that the military will try to give you plenty of time in between mobilizations, so that, ordinarily, you only have to deploy once every 5 years, unless you go out of your way to spend more time on active duty. The urgency of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars put some strain on this model, with exhausted service members being called up more and more frequently. But by the time I joined in 2009, the pace was again fairly steady. I had little concern about being abruptly called up in those first few years. Besides, it was extremely rare for an ensign to be deployed, because your early years are mostly spent figuring out the basics of management and military bearing.
knowledge normally not attributed to officers until they have at least made it to the rank of lieutenant junior grade. But as time went by, I advanced in rank and skills and grew more likely to be mobilized. By 2013, rumor had it that the intelligence community